There has never been a more important time to make a difference and create better lives. I'm Andrew Liveris, former chairman and chief executive officer of the Dow Chemical Company and the former executive chairman of Dow DuPont. In this podcast series, you'll hear from one of our Liveris Academy scholars interviewing a leader they identified as being important to them.
Welcome again to the Liveris Academy Global Leadership Podcast. My name is Vishak Gangasandra, a scholar of the Academy currently studying a double degree of medicine and biotechnology. Over the past year, we've become accustomed to the terms uncertainty, volatility, and change, which have all become synonymous with the global challenges the world is facing. Due to this, however, our attention has been shifted away from the rapid changes in the research and development sector. Over the millennia, society has progressed from the Stone Age to the Industrial Age to the space and digital ages. The advent of the next chapter in humanity is soon approaching, coined as the biological age, where we expect the augmentation of health and well-being with advanced technological innovation. The industry displaying the greatest potential to catalyze this societal shift is that of neuroscience. Today, I'm honored to host leading neuroscience professor from the Yale School of Medicine, Dr. Basavaraju Sanganahalli. Dr. Sanganahalli completed his PhD in neuroscience and has since gone on to publishing over 36 internationally known papers, primarily focusing on fMRI technology and the roots of Alzheimer's disease. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me today.
Your journey is an inspiration to younger aspiring students. Could you talk us through your university and career experiences that led you to where you are today?
Sure. Yeah, I'm Basavaraju Sanganahalli, currently working as a neuroscientist and also a research faculty in the Department of Radiology and Biomedical Imaging at Yale University School of Medicine. First of all, being a postgraduate in physics, I had never dreamt that I'll be doing a neuroscience research someday. It was totally an accident. I moved from solid-state physics career to a neuroscience research. I had a bachelor's degree in electronics and then postgraduate in physics. And during my postgraduate in physics, I was specialized in X-ray crystallography. We are using this tool to understand the structure of single crystals. And also we were introduced to study some small macromolecules and protein structures. There I got interested in multimodal physical tools to study biology at molecular level. So later I did my PhD at National Institute of Mental Health and Neurosciences, Bengaluru, one of the premier neuroscience research institutions in the world. Here I got a solid foundation in fundamental neuroscience. After finishing PhD, I was really looking forward to learning some of the non-invasive multimodal neuroimaging tools to study brain function. So I was fortunate to get into Yale University School of Medicine to do my postdoctoral fellowship in preclinical imaging. After finishing the postdoc, I became research faculty and I've been there since ever.
Wow, it sounds like you've done it all. What stands out clearly is your passion for the field. What inspired you to go into neuroscience and what do you feel makes it such an intellectually stimulating discipline?
We all know that brain is one of the fascinating and incredibly complex organs. I always wondered since childhood, how does brain process sensory information? How we perceive the external world through all of our senses? Like brain continuously receives all of the information from all five important senses like touch, vision, hearing, smell, and taste. It processes the information, stores the information, and recalls the information time to time. All of these processing happens in extremely super speed. You know, the brain is always active, whether waking, sleeping, dreaming. It's a restless brain. Although it weighs only 2% of the body weight, it nearly consumes 20% of the total oxygen inhaled. Why does brain require so much of energy? To give an example, if you just take a 1 milliliter cortical tissue of human brain, it requires around 10^17 ATP per second. For the whole cortical gray area, it requires around 10^20 ATP per second. For 24 hours, the working brain requires like 10^25 ATP per second. Such an incredible energy demanding organ. The ultimate goal of neuroscience is to understand biology of mind, how the complex interaction of genes, proteins, neurons, and circuits can lead to individuality of consciousness and behavior. So recent advances have deepened our understanding of how brain functions. And today, neuroscientists from wide varieties of discipline, I can give examples from biology, psychology, genetics, chemistry, computer programming, physics, engineering, linguistics, medicine, ethics, law, and also philosophy, all employ a powerful arsenal of these techniques to address the biology of mind and to provide insight for treating more than 100 known associated psychiatric and neurological disorders in the brain. I feel this is so exciting to work and learn about how brain processes and information using all these multimodal neuroimaging tools currently available.
It's very fascinating, isn't it? So, Dr. Sanganahalli, in your time at Yale, you're focused on translating theoretical principles to clinical applications around the topic of aging. Could you briefly describe your experience and some of the projects yourself and Yale are planning in the future?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, here at Yale, we have a magnetic resonance research center where we house a very high field MRI preclinical and clinical scanners for various neuroimaging applications. I'm currently using very high field, for example, 9.4 Tesla and 11.7 Tesla preclinical scanner for translational neuroimaging applications. My current research is mainly focused on understanding of biophysics of brain functioning, facilitating the translation of basic science research to various clinical applications. I am currently collaborating with various clinical scientists, both at Yale and also outside Yale, in the preclinical animal models of healthy aging, Alzheimer's disease, epilepsy, early life stress, schizophrenia, stroke, mild TBI, and spinal cord injury. So as we age, we lose our sensory and cognitive abilities. We know that there is aging, there is a brain structural loss in the gray matter and white matter. We can actually assess by using multimodal magnetic resonance imaging, we can assess the brain volume changes in gray matter and also white matter changes. Also, we can use the functional connectivity measurement by using resting state fMRI. Traditional functional magnetic resonance imaging maps the brain activity indirectly, but this resting state fMRI, without giving any stimulus, we acquire series of images for 5 to 10 minutes. Then we take a voxel, either the somatosensory or the motor region, take the series, time series of signal and start coordinating across the different regions of the brain. It shows the functional connectivity. For example, there are certain regions in the brain like prefrontal cortex and posterior cingulate, they're always connected, meaning that they have a default mode networks. So these networks keep changing as we age, and it is more pronounced in some of the neurological disorders like Alzheimer's disease. So that can be actually a biomarker. So right now I am focusing mainly on like studying olfactory dysfunction in aging. We actually lose sense of smell as we age, but it is more pronounced in the Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases. 80 to 95% of the patient lose sense of smell. I'm actually trying to develop a technique to measure the olfactory responses from starting from olfactory bulb to the higher olfactory cortices, and also trying to find out the relationship between the age and the sensory loss in both aging as well as in Alzheimer's disease
models. Wow, sounds like there's so much to be excited for, especially for younger students going into the field and especially for yourself. Now, some believe that society's next greatest leap is in biological innovation. What role does neuroscience and neuroeconomics in particular play, and how important will it be in commercial innovation?
Yeah, this is mainly of neuromarketing. Currently, there are many companies, for example, you take food and beverage industries or a selling company like Amazon, Facebook, Google, already they're using this neuromarketing approach. It's a very complicated business skill, like the field of neuromarketing, sometimes known as consumer neuroscience, which studies the brain to predict and potentially even manipulate consumer behavior and decision-making. So over past few years, several groundbreaking studies have demonstrated its potential to create value for marketers. Just give an example, the beverage companies like Pepsi and Cola always competed with their advertisement, how they can actually deal with the consumer decision-making. So even like a selling company, Amazon, for example, to sell a coffee machine, they actually advertise it's one of the best coffee selling machine and that they actually rate it 5-star. Like people always, the consumer goes with the rating. That's how he's biased. This kind of decision-making is influenced by the ad company. Though all of these companies are using this neuromarketing with artificial intelligence and then trying to sell their product in a better way. Similarly, Google, when you're browsing something on Google and you're associated with Facebook, Facebook started leaving the cookies to know, they already know what you are searching for. Facebook started advertising those products. So these companies are making, you know, they're investing billions of dollars in neuromarketing. Also, there are some technological advances which reshape business in nearly every industry. Many companies are still like basing important decisions on questionnaires, like focus groups, like credit card swiping, and also doing some GPS tracking. And also, if I remember, there are recent breakthroughs in neuroscience are helping us to understand more about what holds person's attention and what motivates them. The potential business applications are really outstanding. So, and I read somewhere recently that some of the business school, there's a famous business school in US like Wharton Business School, that actually introduced Wharton Neuroscience Initiative, which is based on Wharton's Introduction to Brain Science for Business course. This program actually presents a unique opportunity to learn directly from the scientists who are making new discoveries.
Currently, there is much speculation regarding our present capabilities. How much do we currently know in neuroscience, and what could be achieved within our lifetimes in the near future?
Wow, this is a good question. So currently we are using many multimodal neuroimaging tools. Some vary from invasive to non-invasive, and also they range from different spatial and temporal resolution to map brain activity from simple synapse to system level. So throughout brain, the flow and processing of information is mediated by anatomical connection that unifies cells into circuits and circuits into systems. So these connections include both local connections sometimes within specific brain region and long-range connections spanning multiple areas and distances. I can say like future development for next generation of like recording neurotechnologies will increasingly require this participation of scientists, not only from neuroscience, from physics, chemistry, molecular biology, electrical and neuroengineering, material science people, and also computer science people. So development of new generation of large-scale recording tools will permit more incisive investigation of numerous problems in neuroscience that have been approached in only limited ways today. For example, how is sensory information transformed into higher order perception? That's a big question. How is short-term working memory encoded? What are the circuit mechanisms underlying the decision-making? I just spoke about neuromarketing. This is concerned to neuroeconomics. What fundamental logic and neural mechanics mediate motor control? Already technologies are coming home. For example, earlier stroke or Parkinson patient cannot even move their hand. Right now, they can use their remote control to turn on a TV or turn on a light switch. Also, how do multiple brain areas communicate and work together as behavior and task demand change? So how do neuromodulatory signals remodel circuit dynamics and brain states? How are internal cognitive models of world encoded, updated, and accessed, make predictions and guide future actions? I feel we still have a long ways to go on developing these sophisticated neurotechnologies for improving cognitive and behavior.
Leading on from this is a question that I'm sure listeners would be adamant to hear the answer to. Recently, there's been much hype around Elon Musk's Neuralink brain chip, which is being developed to read and transduce brain activity. What are your thoughts on the expansion of such technologies? And where do other emerging industries such as big data and AI fit within the field of neuroscience?
Oh, this is a great question. Yeah, in my lifetime, I didn't think that it will happen so fast, but it is emerging. First of all, this is a great invention and very cool technology. I don't know, the listeners might know, the Neuralink basically works by recording and decoding electrical signals from the brain using like more than 1,000 electrodes implanted in different regions of the brain. For example, we can implant this kind of electrode into your motor cortex that can coordinate hand and arm movements. Using these data, we can calibrate and decode by mathematically modeling the relationship between the patterns of neural activity and different movements they produce. This actually helps, for example, neural prosthetics. So currently there is a project I can go in detail about. It's called a Big Brain Project. I think it's in Canada. Just to give some brief background, neuroimaging methods mainly rely on accurate brain models has grown to develop reliable approaches for probing the brain. Researchers in brain simulation and artificial intelligence have a growing need for detailed description of internal organization of brain regions in terms of local morphology, like cell densities or connectivity. Currently, established computer-based 3D neuroimaging tools cannot reproduce freshly cut brains, particularly for very convoluted like cortical regions and in subcortical areas. With the advent of this big brain, a human postpartum brain that has been sectioned, stained for cell bodies, scanned at very high resolution, and then they digitally reconstruct in 3D, they believe that there will be an improvement in precision and quality of neuroimaging support for qualitative and quantitative investigation of the brain. This is very fascinating because they aim to extend their model by further increasing resolution and integrating multimodal data, working closely with the neuroimaging community, brain modeling and artificial intelligence communities to unleash the potential of research. Currently, there is also human connectome projects, and the big brain project. They're all working synchronously with all this machine learning and AI approach.
With neuroscience playing an integral aspect to our future, leadership in the industry is crucial. How can innovation in neuroscience be dealt by effective and decisive leadership to ensure regulation to maintain privacy, autonomy, etc.?
This is a question regarding the neuroscience of business. It is going from public to political. For example, last US election, how this played a big role in even the political election too. So innovations in leadership and strategic decisions will show how the brain works and how to apply neuroscience principle in any organization to shape and improve management, for example, team building and innovation, and learn how neuroscience can enhance talent identification, like improve team selection, monitor training, enhance and broadening and cultural fit, enrich marketing and communication strategies, and improve client relationship. Again, to improve leadership capabilities by understanding the science of decision-making, including how neural constraint can lead to poor decisions and how to overcome them. So they're actually trying many approaches, apply brain training and cognitive enhancement with any organization to improve productivity, cultural fit, and job satisfaction, etc. This is just of what I have learned through the literature. But many companies are already recruiting psychologists to assess their personal stress and cognitive behavior. They're trying to improve or enhance their productivity by using a lot of approaches to get a business output.
So given this, what can we as members of the public and potential scientific researchers be doing right now to lead and encourage investment into biotechnological improvement?
Of course, it needs huge public support in many ways. Investing like taxpayers' money on research, increasing federal funding to conduct research. Always there is a huge demand for federal funding to conduct research. The substantial investment needed for a target discovery and validation are spread across public. Since I live here, I know like National Institute of Health and National Science Foundation are the major like federal funding agencies, and also partnering with industry and private funders, lowering the risk to any one entity. Several countries have recognized the urgent need to invest in brain research as a priority for economic development and improved health of their citizens. Over the past several years, many countries and I think recently European Union launched a large-scale projects nearing $1 billion investment. So what we call this IBI, International Brain Initiative, has been established to coordinate these kind of efforts across existing and emerging national and regional brain initiatives. Actually, US also did, during Obama administration care, they bought this program called Brain Initiative, developing new technologies and funding to improve technologies for early biomarker detection. So this NeuroNew describes how to be involved and new opportunities for global collaboration that are emerging between scientists, scientific societies, for example, funding agencies and industry, government and the society.
And if members of the public right now wanted to invest in these biotechnological companies, would there be a substantial return on their investment? And would you personally recommend that they do so to benefit not only themselves, but the wider community?
A lot of people are trying that already. You know, they're also government is giving like some small scale industries a lot of support to do that. They are actually collaborating with a lot of academic people, taking from a molecule from bench to bedside, for example, treatment therapies. So it's a big thing, like going from phase one to phase two to phase three. It is not a jump. It's actually a coordinated information, from the small scale industries and academic universities and the support from the government.
By the sounds of it, creativity will become everything in the future, especially for scientists. So how can aspiring scientists harness creativity to succeed in medical research? And what can they do to become transformational leaders?
Yeah, this is the most important thing. So I insist on the convergence approach to just explain what is this convergence. The integration of life sciences, like physical sciences, mathematics, engineering, and information technology, often referred to as the convergence, has emerged in very recent years as a powerful approach to research with the potential to lead medical and technological breakthroughs. So investing in convergence from early research through clinical applications will transform health and provide healthcare cost savings. The example number one, like convergence can enhance early diagnosis. Catching problems at their outset can save on like costly later stage or last minute treatment. And also, with these neurotechnologies like wearable smart devices that monitor health and wellness will alert patients and doctors to incipient health issues. Paired with advances in health information technologies that integrate molecular and genomic data, wearable monitors can also help to prevent disease progression. Meanwhile, there are some algorithms to enable data-driven medical decision, can help doctors to use best available evidence quickly. Convergence can also increase the effectiveness of treatments. New immunotherapies and vaccines will enable our own bodies to, you know, better fight the disease. Minimally invasive medical devices, including those deployed recent development in nanotechnologies, they actually save the, you know, the instrumentation size, will provide steady regulated drug release along with powerful tools for investigating, you know, subcellular process. I can also talk about nano robots, what we call for drug delivery. So there are some new regenerative and cell engineering strategies for tissue and organ repair will reduce the need for organ transplant and heal wounds faster. And new smart prosthetics like robotic arms and hands will connect to the central nervous system. So wearers can sense the world and control their movement. These are some of the examples.
There are claims that many psychological studies provide inconclusive or incorrect results resulting from the high pressures of journals to output publications. As the saying goes, publish or perish. Do you feel it is important for future scientists to be aware of this? And would you suggest that there be a greater push to nurture ethical, conscientious scientists?
Yeah, as a scientist, we all need to publish our data to document our findings. We all get benefits, you know, from the published work or the published documents. Sometimes there is a pure pressure to publish in high-impact journals. Example, publishing in very high-index journal like Science, Nature, Cell takes much, much longer time because it has to undergo like rigorous review and it is time-consuming. Sometimes it takes like 1.5 to 2 years. I personally face this thing. Secondly, some of the biological experiments require more sample sizes, and also there is a concern for statistics nowadays. For example, like physics experiments, we measure acceleration due to gravity, g is equal to 9.8 meter per second square. Like quick trials are enough to get, you know, reproducibility, but biological experiment, reproducibility, repetitive, and sample sizes are a big concern. So now actually we are moving, like, you know, big journals are saying that the statistics p less than 0.05 is no more valid. We need to go very higher. That means you need to have more sample sizes. So there is enormous amount of stress involved too in your organization or the funding agencies. They always demand to publish in high quality of journals. And I myself, as being a scientist, get biased when I'm reading some new article. I always go and look at a review article which is published in a high impacted journals, even though we know that, you know, it's, this is the system, but we are all, you know, scientists. We have to do our best.
That's very true what you're saying. Now, to finish off, I'd like to ask, what should young people passionate about medical innovation be doing now to help change the world in the future?
First of all, you have to develop a passion. Deciding that what you want to be or what you want to do is the first step in making any success in any field, right? You have to have a patience, develop a grit, no procrastination, understand that. And we all do mistakes. Mistakes or failures are a vital part of discovery. And as a young investigator, first of all, you have to find an advisor who will listen to you and your ideas and thoughts, no matter how far or short along your career path you are. I have found this myself crucial to building scientific confidence early on, starting in my undergrad. Try to network and attend conferences, even if you feel like you don't have to do contribute anything. So there will be established people. For example, I go to Society of Neuroscience. There are 40,000 people accumulate in one place. And they go from the neurosciences emerge from basic neuroscience to developmental to computational neuroscience. There is a vast area and different experts all over the world are coming and discussing their, you know, discoveries. So these established people in the field will see it is as a privilege to interact with you. Don't become specialist too early. That's my, experience. It's great if you can amass a multitude of experience as it will always not only be fuel your growth, but also enrich your skill set and approaches, and might give you very valuable perspective that differ from this niche expert. That's all I can say with my experience.
Well, thank you very much for that message. I'm sure that our discussion today would have helped in inspiring the next generation of neuroscience leaders. It has been a pleasure to have you here today, Dr. Sanganahalli.
Thank you. I really enjoyed the conversation.
I'm Vishak Gangasandra, and that brings us to the end of this episode of the Liveris Academy Global Leadership Podcast. With today's discussion, we've learned how our future will be marked by the infusion of disciplines to augment our well-being, and that we are in desperate need of critical problem solvers like all of you listeners. So whether you're studying medicine, biotechnology, engineering, business, arts, or any other field of your choice, stay passionate, because you get to decide what the world is tomorrow. This podcast was recorded by Vishak Gangasandra, with production and editing by Daniel Seed, and supported by the University of Queensland.